Oh my God, Harold, look at the phone cord. It's been so long since we've seen Martin's phone cord. He used to hang down there when he had the camera at a different angle. I missed it, but there it is. Of course, not let you forget your favorites, the greatest hits, which includes the phone cord, part of my tableau here in the laundry room. Welcome to another program. Got things a little turned around here. This would be a roll of paper towels. You know what I do with that. Behind closed doors. And we are in the book of Revelation, the last chapter of the book of Revelation. It's really winding down. To tell you the truth, I could possibly finish this series in a week. Nah, then again, I know myself and you know me. I couldn't do it. We're going to luxuriate here. We're going to have fun in the last 14 shows. We're going to remember the good days. We're going to remember the good old days of the Revelation series, which were actually fraught with trial. I find that I do my best work, really, under trial, under pressure. I've told you this. So many people have told me that the shows I've done when I've been really down and like, the last thing I want to do is do a show or write a newsletter. And when I persevere, when I push through the wall, I end up producing something that's really transcendent because it comes out of pain. It comes out of realness. And I think maybe, God, that was a horrible show. And then I'm told over and over again, man, Martin, that was one of the best shows that really got to me. Why did it get to you, my friend? Because you found out that you and I share the same dashed hopes and dreams. We share the same expectations of our future. We share the same trials here, the same concerns, and we are infused by the same spirit, the spirit of Christ. That makes us kin. Yes. Blood might be thicker than water, but spirit is thicker than blood. So we're in Revelation 22, and we find John coming back to the island of Patmos. I, John, am the one hearing and observing these things. And he was the only one. There weren't all these cooks spoiling the broth. John didn't set up a platform there on Patmos and say, I'd like to hear everybody else's opinion. He didn't write his revelation down and ask for the opinion of other commentators. No, and I think that's a real flaw in the body of Christ that we need to feel so open-minded because we're victims, not beneficiaries, victims of an era where political correctness is everything. You can't hurt anyone's feelings. Everyone deserves a fair hearing. So John should have really opened this up for debate. He should have held a conference, invited any speaker like open mic night at the comedy club, and anybody that wants to comment, bring them in. You have to include their remarks in the revelation. They're important too. They have feelings. Their words are valuable even though they're stupid. Their thoughts are valuable even though they're wrong. Now John says, I myself heard and observed these things. I, John, am the one hearing and observing these things. And when I hear and observe, I fall to worship in front of the feet of the messenger who is showing me these things. So, you know, I said this could have been a messenger who was disguised as an ordinary human being. I still maintain that because the things that the messenger did, taking John on a magical mystery tour, would have been things worthy of falling to the feet over. And I don't blame John one bit. But again, we talked about how the messenger humbled itself, said that it too was a servant, a fellow slave of yours, and of your brethren, the prophets, and those keeping the sayings of the scroll. And the last line of this passage, verse 9, says, worship God. Worship God. Now, worship is a generic word. It just means toward team. It's dog-like fawning over a person or an object. Jesus told a parable about a man who worshipped a man, the slaveholder who had the power to retain him or sell him back into slavery. He was a debtor to the man. He falls down and worships, and there's nothing wrong with that as long as you don't worship a person as God. That's the thing. There's only one God. You worship God as God. You don't worship beings as God. And apparently John was worshiping this being as God. And that's uncomfortable for any being. People did that to Peter one time. When Peter healed the lame man, people began to worship him. And they did this to Paul and Barnabas. They wanted to build a monument to Paul and Barnabas. They thought Paul was Zeus and Barnabas was Hermes, two Greek gods, and they wanted to worship to them, sacrifice to them, and probably name holidays after them and give gifts to one another. Paul and Barnabas arrested that proceeding quickly and said, no, we are but men. They were starting to worship them as gods, as God, capital G. And I think that's happening here. I don't like it. John didn't like it either. Lo, I am coming swiftly, and my wage is with me to pay each one as his work is. All through this book, and here, it never stops. We're in chapter 22. Even with the seven ecclesias, it's all based on work. I know of your works. I know of your devotion. I know of your faith. And those ecclesias that weren't so highly recognized, it was, you didn't do this. You listen to the words of the prophetess Jezebel. You listen to Balaam or Balak. You are like those in the wilderness. And so it all depends on works, whether good or bad. And this is consistent. Now, it's true that Jesus Christ will have a wage for us at the dais of Christ. We will be paid a wage if we have suffered evil with the evangel in accord with competing in the word and running the race according to the rules. But this wage that we are paid, the wreath of righteousness Paul was seeking for, it was not salvation. That's not salvation. We are given wages and we are given trophies and medals above and beyond basic salvation, because basic salvation comes to us, 2 Timothy 1:9, not according to our acts. Okay, so you need to remember that. But here, in the unveiling chapter 22, this is aeonian life being given according to work, because whoever doesn't overcome will not eat of the tree of life. Where is that? That's on the new earth in the new Jerusalem during Aeon 5. If you're not eating of that tree, the log of life, then you must be dead. And if you're dead during Aeon 5, it means you were dead during Aeon 4, raised at the great white throne. Your works found to be lacking, and you're cast into the lake of fire, which is the second death, and you don't come to until the consummation, when death is abolished. 1 Corinthians 15:26. Now, for these people, my wage is with me. I'm coming swiftly. This is like the bridegroom again. Jesus told this parable, and nobody knows the hour at which he's coming. You know the season, but not the hour. But the Jews who are asleep, they won't even know the season. No. The majority of the Jews won't even know the season. So they're going to be totally unaware. The bridegroom's going to show up. Then they're going to think, oh, let me put on my makeup. Too late. The car's pulling away. You missed your ride. You missed everything. You missed a wedding feast. You missed the kingdom. You missed a log of life. You missed everything. Regroup in the lake of fire. But my friends, remember this. Nobody regroups in the lake of fire. The lake of fire is, for humans, the second death. We're going to get to that here in a little bit. He's saying to me, you should be sealing the sayings of the prophecy of this scroll, for the era is near. Oh, you know, I skipped this part. I went on to verse 12. I think I skipped verse 11. Didn't mean to take these out of order, but you should not be sealing the sayings. Okay, he is saying to me, you should not be sealing the sayings of this prophecy of this scroll, for the era is near. And the error is near too. That was a Freudian slip. The error is near. It is near. The apostasy was already underway when John wrote this, but just like Paul's message has apostasy that clouds it, hides it from view, this message also, that of the circumcision, the evangel of the circumcision, also has apostasy associated with it. Every legitimate message of God will have apostasy associated with it. This is no exception. It's the rule, in fact. He's saying to me, you should not be sealing the sayings of the prophecy of this scroll. So John wrote it. But you notice at this juncture, it doesn't say here that he's supposed to send it to the seven ecclesias. Once he's in spirit in the Lord's day, and he's been shown the ecclesias, which I believe, and others of other notable personages agree with me, they say that these ecclesias are future. He's told to write to them while he's in the Lord's day, but here he's back on Patmos, and he's not told to send it to the seven ecclesias. And in fact, as I have said, one of those ecclesias was Laodicea. There was a council of Laodicea, an early century, perhaps the 3rd century, at the latest the 4th century, maybe 250, 300 years removed from John. And there is no record that this epic letter from an epic disciple of the epic Christ ever reached them. It was not found on any magazine rack in any doctor's office or dentist office or psychiatrist's office in the entire land of Laodicea. So, another proof that these letters are future. Let the injurer injure still, let the filthy one be filthy still. I've always known this verse, but my gosh, I just got a new thought on this. If this letter had been sent to contemporary ecclesias, then the call would have been to not remain filthy, to not stay dirty, and to not keep injuring people. The word would have been out. Hey, shape up. Hey, be like the Philadelphians, or be like the Smyrnians, or be like the any other ones. Do the right thing. But this suggests to me, it's another piece of evidence, I would say, or at least a strong suggestion. I've never seen this before. This is part of the joy of winging it. That this letter did not go to contemporary ecclesias, because the word is, let those, it's unbelievable. Let the filthy one be filthy still. Let the injurer injure still. Let the filthy one be filthy still. And let the just one do righteousness still. Let the holy one be hallowed still. It's like, in whatever state you find yourself, just keep being that way. This is telling me nothing's going to change until the end era. Because this was not the end era, because nothing has changed. If anyone has not continued to be filthy still, who was filthy then we could say, oh, perhaps the era of the end came back then, near the end of the first century, when John was writing this letter. But since everything has remained filthy, since those injuring continue to injure, and since those few ones of the remnant who are righteous continue to be righteous, there's a remnant down to the current day because we're in the current era, Romans 11, then I say this letter is for future ecclesias. God, I make sense for a living. I'll never get tired of this. This is great. I cannot stop doing some kind of series because making sense for a living just feels good. All right. And really, does Christianity say this today? This is John the Apostle. And he's saying, let the injurer injure still. Because he knows the absolute sovereignty of God. He knows that God is the author of both good and evil. Isaiah 45:7, I create good, I create evil, I the Lord do all these things. And he knows that there is meant to be those who injure. That apart from those who injure, there cannot be this crisis. Apart from those who are filthy, there cannot be this crisis. There cannot be a contrast either, a crisis or a contrast. The crisis of the beast and the prostitute joining forces. The contrast of those who are doing righteousness. The contrast between them and those who remain filthy, unjust, and who injure. There must be these two kinds of people so that we can have the drama. So that we can write the novel, so that we can appreciate the protagonist. You can't have a protagonist unless you have an antagonist against which the protagonist can shine. David and Goliath. What good is David if there's no Goliath? He doesn't have an opportunity, David doesn't. He doesn't have a field of display. He doesn't have a ground, a battleground that he can display his prowess upon. So there's this gigantic, stinky 9'9" freakazoid of the Philistines And David slays him. Great. Let the Goliaths of the world remain filthy. This is an amazing testimony of a man who understands the sovereignty of God. He's not saying, everybody be good. Everybody behave yourselves. He's saying, that's it. Scroll's over. Done with the scroll. Done writing it. If you're filthy, just go ahead and stay filthy. Not a problem, really. If you're righteous, if you're doing good works, stay that way. Great. Glad to hear it. Nothing's going to change from now, that is when John wrote this letter, until the final years of Millennium 6. And these Christians who are praying for the world to become one, all this kumbaya crap, both spelled with a K, is so self-deceived. And who do these Christians think they are? That they have the power to overcome prophecy. To overcome 2 Timothy chapter 3, perilous periods will be present in the last days. To overcome Revelation 22, let the filthy be filthy still. Oh, no, 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 John. We're going to encourage the filthy to be clean. We're going to build programs. We're going to design workbooks where we can distribute all around the earth. We're going to reach the world for Christ before the end of this century or millennium or whatever their crazy dream is, and we're going to bring a world in subjection to God's feet. And they're going to be mighty proud of ourselves. It's going to be a lot of cigars being smoked in that day, boy. Haha, but no. Here's a man of wisdom. Here's an old man. Man who stroked his beard and said, you know what? Things aren't going to get any better until Jesus Christ physically returns to take away your reverence from Jacob. I don't know if you've watched the news lately, but that hasn't happened. That hasn't happened yet. Preterists, 70 AD people. Hasn't happened yet. Remove your reverence from Jacob, bring an end to deceit, consummate the evil, and then abolish it. According to the preterists, Revelation took place in 70 AD. We should be on the new earth right now. Because apparently the millennium would have ended sometime in 1000 AD if Jesus Christ returned and the millennium, so-called spiritual millennium, began at that time. Then in 1070 AD, the millennium should have ended. Oh, by the way, Satan would have been bound during that time. So look at world history between AD 70 and 1000 AD and tell me if there are any discolored events, mayhem being enacted upon the earth. If so, then I would say it would be a great evidence that Satan was not bound during that time. And if this is the new earth, I want a frickin' refund. If this is the new earth, and this is God's idea of no more death, if this is God's idea of looking into the face of God, not having the need of the sun or moon, no more misery, no more tears, no more clamor, no more doom, I'm disappointed. I want my money back. It's a sham. It's a fake. And God himself is a charlatan. Oh, but he's not, because the preterists are crazily wrong. They're insanely mistaken. And the book of Revelation is future, yet future. And my commentary upon the next few verses, which are considerable, are also, at this time, future.